journey on. The magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
Just because he knows that you know.
G'day everyone, welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I'm your host Warwick Schiller, and in this episode of the podcast, I have the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Jim Masterson of the Masterson Method. And this was one of my favorite conversations just because of the way it went down. But, Jim does a method of body work on horses that has not just a profound change on the horse's body, but on their mind too. And what I really think he's onto here is he's taken the tension out of the mind, which actually takes the tension out of the body. But you know, the thing about Jim is I've been wanting to know is, how did he figure this stuff out? Like he's figured some stuff out that you have to have a certain outlook on the world to have. And let me just read you from his website what it says about Jim. It says, in 1998, Jim was grooming horses on the US Hunter Jumper show circuit, and he noticed while watching physical therapists work on horses that the horse exhibited certain subtle changes in behavior that correlated with what the therapists were doing. He learned that if you trust and follow what the horse is telling you as you work on it, the horse's body will participate in the process of releasing tension. The result, not only an improvement in the performance, but also in the trust that develops between the horse and the human. And think about the first line of that. Jim was grooming horses. How do you go, this is my big question, how do you go from being a horse groom to thinking about things that way? And that was probably my big thing I wanted to talk to Jim about, was that. And I think he thought we're going to talk about the Masterson Method, but what I wanted to know was, how does a average human being figure that stuff out? And so I had to do some searching, because Jim didn't think the conversation was going that way, but I finally got to the bottom of how he developed a mindset like that. And it's so fascinating, because it goes so much along with a lot of topics that have come up in these podcasts. I don't want to really give the game away, but it's, yeah, I know I can't give you the game away, because it's so cool. It so ties in with a lot of stuff we've talked about in the podcast, especially the podcast with Rupert Isaacson, actually, funnily enough. So anyway, I won't tease you any longer. Let's get into this podcast with Jim Masterson. This is going to be fun. Jim Masterson, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
Thanks. Thank you. I'm happy to do this and talk with you. So it's interesting, because, you know, it's an interview, but, and I know you have maybe questions for me and things, but it's kind of, I'm interested to see how what we do here blends in with what you do, because of so many people that do our type of body work resonate with your work too. So, I've only been to met you at a couple of horse expos, and I watched part of one of your presentations, but I had to get back to my booth. So I never really got I liked what I saw, but I never really got a full picture. So,
you know, those horse expos, they're a little hard that way, because there's all these people you want to go and see what they do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you never get to really do it, because you're busy with all your stuff. And usually someone I really want to see ends up on the same time I am. And so I'm kind of really looking forward to the Best Horse Practices Summit sometime this year in Kentucky, because it's a summit. So there's only one person talking at a time. So you get to, you get to be in the audience and watch all the stuff. But yeah, those horse expos can be a bit of a three-ring circus, can't they? So yeah, you said there's a bit of crossover between what I do and what you do, and maybe let's start out talking about, if people aren't familiar with the Masterson Method, what is it you do?
Well, it's a type of equine body work where you learn to read and follow subtle changes in the horse's body language, which I call responses. The responses as you're doing the work, and if you pay attention to what the horse is telling you through these changes in body language, then, and you follow that, it leads to the horse releasing pretty deep levels of tension. So it's a method of equine body work where you follow the responses of the horse to help it release tension. And when I started picking up on this when I was grooming hunter jumpers, and I kind of came across it just by observing other therapists working on horses. I was just grooming, and I noticed these little changes. And I started experimenting with it, and it turned into something that really worked. And when I realized people would want to learn this because it's really interactive with the horse, my wife said, well, you're going to have to come up with an explanation for it, because it's not massage and it's not chiropractic. It's a different thing. And so she said, you have to have a 15-second elevator speech to say, you know, if you were in the elevator for 15 seconds with somebody, how would you describe? And so it's a method of equine body work where we learn to read and follow the responses of the horse to touch to help it release tension in the key junctions of the body that most affect performance. So I started out with this to improve performance in horses, but the interactive nature of it just appealed to a lot of people, and they wanted to start to learn it. So it eventually guided me to this, you know, teaching people how to do it.
You know, something I've been on about for quite a while, connecting with horses is attunement, you know, and attunement is described by UCLA professor of psychology, Daniel Siegel, as the sense of being seen and being heard. And there's a trauma therapist from Canada, and her name is Sarah Schlotte, and she goes a little further, and she says it's the attunement is the sense of being seen, being heard, feeling felt, and getting gotten. And, you know, I've been to a two-day Masterson workshop with Sandy Vreeburg, and the thing that I got from that was it is so much – what you do is so much about attunement. It's really that – you know, and you said it releases tension, but you're not rubbing the tension out of them. You're connecting the tension out of them. You're letting them know that you see the subtlest things, one blink, one little thing, and then you stand back and you wait, and the magic happens. And I'm sure you see this at your workshops all the time, but the one with Sandy, I saw it there to where people will start to have emotional responses too. And I really think I noticed it about 3 years ago doing my clinics, when I really started people waiting for horses to let down, just being there and just setting it up and then just standing there and waiting. And I'd have people that would start crying. And I've had people cry at my clinics in the past, but it wasn't because they were waiting. It's because of something I said.
Yeah.
And like, I'd go over and say, you okay? And they're like, yeah, I was just thinking about something my dad said to me when I was a kid, or something like that. And for a while I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. But when you are really present, if you're not used to being present, stuff comes up. I think the Masterson method of equine body work is a whole lot more than that, because I really think that the people practicing it have to change something about themselves, or doing some of the stuff, it changes. It sets you up for changes. And I bet you're kind of surprised that is one of the, you know, the outcomes from what you're doing.
Well, yeah, you know, when I was working on the hunter jumpers, and I did that for 9 years, and I worked on, you know, like 700 horses a year for, you know, probably 7 years straight on the hunter jumper circuit. And because it worked, you know, they don't call you back if it's about results. So it worked. It got the horses to release tension. I got them moving better. But that whole interactive part is what makes it work. You know, that's what made it effective. And that's why it kind of led to this direction of teaching it. And I think of more of sharing it and making a living sharing it. But what you're saying about, you know, attunement or being in tune isn't just about seeing what's going on with the horse. It's when you see, like, I'll use the blink, for example, or the bladder meridian. You're going down the bladder meridian really lightly with no pressure. You're not putting any pressure on the horse, and you get a blink because the horses feel it. You just crossed over a point that the horse felt something. And then, so you saw that, what the horse had to say. So that means something. There's a correlation there. And then when you wait and do nothing and don't put any pressure on, and the horse starts to release tension, and then you step back, the horse got that you got what it was saying. And I heard you talk about that too. And I was thinking, oh, there's the money. It's not just tuning into the horse. It's like allowing the horse to tune into you by putting no pressure on it. So, and finding something there that the horse is feeling, and then you're responding to it too. It's not the horse responds. There's the search for the response and stay for the release. But when you stop and stay and don't do anything, that's the horse gets that you got something. And that's a whole nother layer of it, you know.
Yeah, that's that whole sense of being seen, being heard, feeling felt, getting gotten. Yeah. And I want to talk quite a bit about that, but I want to know the beginnings of that. Like, you were groomed for hunter jumpers before you started doing this. How did you get into, say, being a groom for hunter jumpers? I mean, what's your background? How'd you get there?
I my whole career hasn't been horses. You know, I had my horse when I was a kid, and my best buddy's dad owned a ranch for a couple of years where we lived, and we moved around a lot. My dad was a pilot, but you know, he had a horse when he was younger, and then so when I was younger, I was around horses, and you know, we all connect with horses, that you can't not if you're being around them. But then I was away from horses for a long time, and then in 1997. Here in Fairfield, Iowa, I was kind of between jobs and looking for something to do, and I didn't want to get a real job.
Can I ask what you were doing all that time?
When I was 14, we moved overseas, and we lived overseas in various places for quite a few years till I left high school, and then I went to Alaska and I fought forest fires and I worked on the pipeline, and then I moved to Wyoming and worked in the oil field for about 9 or 10 years, and you know, nothing related to horses that would connect with this. You know, being a roughneck isn't exactly lead you down to this path. But
okay, well, let's just back up a second, because you kind of just brushed over. Yeah, I fought forest fires, and then you went on to something else. Tell me about that.
Well, I was always just looking for fun jobs to do, so fun things to do, and if I didn't enjoy what I was doing, I wouldn't last at it. You know, I've never had a job that I didn't enjoy doing that I lasted more than a few months. So, and my dad was a pilot. He was a contract pilot, so he would fly for a couple of years in one country, and then that contract would expire, and we'd move somewhere else. So it was always
a commercial pilot.
Yeah, cargo, air transport pilot, yeah.
So what countries have you lived in?
Well, when I was really young, we lived in Mexico for about half a year. And then when I was in my teens, we moved to Spain for a year. Then we moved to Africa for 2 years.
Where in Africa?
Democratic Republic of the Congo. It was Zaire for a little while.
Yeah.
You know, my dad led an adventurous life. He usually ended up flying someplace where there was war or problems, you know, like there wasn't a war going on there. But when we first moved to Spain, he was flying in Biafra, the Biafran airlift, which is a pretty, you know, adventurous thing to do. But we lived in Spain because you couldn't live in Biafra. And then after that was over, we moved to the Congo for 2 years. And then when that was over, we moved back to Spain. He went to work in Cambodia, and then I graduated high school in Spain, and then went to Alaska because I wanted, you know, it was just like adventure. So that's what I was always looking for. But there was one thing when we lived in Africa that kind of might relate to the working with horses or reading horses, is we had a lot of monkeys, you know. Once the locals knew I loved animals, they just started bringing things out of the jungle. You know, we had a chimpanzee. I had two small baboons. I had an albino monkey that had white hair and pink skin and blue eyes. And their body language and their facial expressions kind of get close to human, you know. So I would just spend time with these primates, you know, like the monkey on my lap, and we'd do a little grooming things and pay. I'd look at their facial expressions and they'd look at mine, and I'd change my facial expression, and that would get a reaction out of them. So for example, baboons, they have white eyelids, and when they're showing surprise or fear or aggression, they'll put their eyelids up. So, you know, like that. And well, this is a recording, but anyways, they'll raise their eyelids and show these white.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'd be sitting with a baboon on my lap. I was 16, and then I'd be doing this little grooming thing with them and licking my lips, and then they would relax and kind of do what baboons, it's a social, you know, activity. And then I would show them my eyelid for like half a second, and they'd like grab something and they'd shake it. But anyways, it was playing with these subtle little, they weren't so subtle, these changes in body language. And when I thought back at one point while I was working with horses, I thought, wow, you know, I used to do this with our animals, you know, when I was younger, and it kind of got me, there was a connection there. So I don't know if this is horse talk or not, but it's
my podcast is never about horse talk, and this is the stuff I want to hear. You were gonna brush over this year. My dad was a pilot, and then I did some fires, and then I started on the horses. Forget the horses. We all get horses here. I want to know the backstory because, and well, you know, this. I'm fascinated by Africa. I had a fella on the podcast here a few weeks ago that spent a lot of time in Africa, and that podcast kind of changed something inside me. But I've always been fascinated with Africa, and the fact that you lived in the Congo and had pet baboons and chimpanzees just kind of blows me away. That is very, very cool. You know, the reason I asked you about what countries you lived in, because I really think that if you've lived in different countries that have different cultures, it changes. You know, there's the old saying, going away and coming back's not the same as never having gone away. You know, so if you live in the middle of Iowa and then you go and live in, I don't know, Africa for 2 years and then you come back to Iowa, Iowa does not look the same as it did before you left. And so you've had the opportunity to immerse yourself in several different cultures, and that's got to add a lot to who you are, you know.
Well, it does. It opens up it changes your perspective, and you start, you don't even know you're thinking outside of the box or acting outside of the box, because there, you don't know where the box is, you know, until you get back here. And then, you know, well, there's a box here, and I'm not necessarily staying within the lines, but you do gain a different perspective, just like you said, by being in different cultures and, seeing the way people live and not taking things for granted, for example, would be an example of something that you get when you're living out in different cultures. And you know that because, you know, you're from a different place and you traveled yourself. So,
yeah, well, I'm from a different place, but, you know, Australian culture and the US culture, they're different, but they're not different like living in Africa, Europe, Asia, you know, they're all completely different. Australia and America's similar enough to be similar, but different enough to be different, but it's not completely different. It's not like you go to Italy and everybody, you know, stops for lunch different things like that.
Australia is closer to living in America than it is, you know, in England, living in America, comparing that.
Like, right, yeah.
I noticed in Australia, you have wider streets like we have. People are a little more open like we are. They drive on the other side of the road and they talk a little funny. But other than that, there's a lot of similarities, you know, in the culture. And you know, like the 50s in Australia were kind of like the 50s in America, you know, music-wise and culture-wise, I think, from listening to people there. But I know what you mean. But you do gain a different perspective if you live in different cultures. And I moved around a lot. Just when I was growing up, we were moving around. And then it seems when, you know, I come from a big family, 7 boys and a girl, and seems as they left home, they all spun off and they had this, centrifugal force that kind of kept them moving around, you know? So.
And where do they live now?
Well, 3 have passed away. My oldest brother lived in Hong Kong and Singapore a long time, and he passed away a few years ago in Hawaii. My second oldest brother lives in France, and he's been there for, you know, decades. He's married to an English woman. My other 2 older brothers, one lives here in Iowa and one's in Southern California. We're from Southern California originally.
The one that's into the boats?
Yeah, he lives on his boat.
Because I met him at the Horse Expo.
Rick.
Somewhere back east, it was called.
Yeah, Was that, Rick, he probably was in, it was probably up at the Western States maybe, or Pomona.
No, I met him back east.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I met him at, it wasn't Madison, Wisconsin. It was Minnesota Horse Expo, yeah. That's where I met him. So he's into boats and he's in San Diego?
He's in L.A. Harbor. Quite a few of my brothers. I have two little brothers who have passed away, and they were into sailing. And my two older brothers who you met and his twin are into sailing. And I sailed a lot. And so we all have a kind of my dad loved boats, and a lot of pilots, they connect with sailing for some reason. You know, you're in the elements, you know, sailing.
Yeah. So you kind of were going to gloss over, I've done a lot of sailing too, but maybe let's hear a bit about that. Cause you know, I'm not much, I grew up in, you know, rural Australia. And so I'm not much of a ocean person. I just haven't spent a lot of time in it. My son lives in Hawaii now and he's really into surfing. But I was at a horse expo in Pomona a couple of years ago and I was talking to Kurt Pate, and this lady walked up and started chatting to Kurt, and I guess she's been in some of his clinics or whatever, and she said she used to be a surfer. Uh-huh. And she said to me, you know, but now I'm into horses, she said, because, you know, you can't have a relationship with a surfboard. And I said, yeah, but your surfboard's just like the saddle. The ocean is what you have the relationship with. And she went, yeah. Oh, yeah, I never thought of it that way. Yeah. But, yeah, I imagine if you're a pilot, you're having a relationship with the air, and if you're a sailor, you're having a relationship with something fluid and moving and happens to be a liquid and not a gas.
Yeah, well, the weather and the water, you know. Yep. Sailing is the weather and the water, and flying is the weather and the air, you know, and A lot of pilots, they sail or retire. When they retire, they sail. So my dad was like that. He loved the ocean and loved sailboats. And it's the, you know, it's the elements that are, it's like you said, it's not about the surfboard, it's about the wave. And my nephew, my oldest brother's boy, is in Hawaii, and he was born there. And he teaches surfing and Hawaiian culture. He blends them together, the mythology of actually the way the weather, the Hawaiian mythology and weather patterns. Yep. And how it relates to surfing. So it's a huge relationship for him with the ocean surfing. So.
Which island is he on?
He's on Oahu.
Is he really?
On the Kailua side. Yeah.
Really?
Or Kaneohe side.
Huh. The Hawaiian culture, my son's been educating me a bit about Hawaiian culture, and it's really cool because they were people who were connected to the land and, of course, the ocean. Yeah.
Well, Ian, my nephew, he has a whole program he teaches at Hawaiian Pacific University on Hawaiian mythology and Hawaiian gods and how they relate to different weather patterns and sea patterns, you know, from all the way back to Polynesia. It's pretty interesting, you know, and it's just, it all comes from surfing for him, that whole cultural thing, you know. And so it's funny, you know, when you look deeper at things, there's a lot of depth to stuff that might seem superficial on the surface, like surfing. Yeah, it's not about getting on a board and going down the face of a wave so much. There's a lot more to it. It's in horses too. I mean, they're so, well, I don't want to keep bringing it back to horses, but you know what I mean. I mean, there's just like incredible depth to horses. It's not just what they're doing on the outside. You know, you don't get just getting on them and going and having them do stuff. It's like what's going on the inside that's pretty fascinating to me. I don't know. There was a certain point where I didn't want to ride anymore. I just wanted to do body work on the horses.
You know, I read a book a few years ago. It's called Equus Lost. It's still around here somewhere. And I got halfway through that book and I stopped reading it because I thought, you know what? If I finish this book, I might not ride horses anymore.
Yeah. So it's not like, I don't think my horses enjoy when I do things with them. You know, when I do go for a trail ride or, I drive them. I have two Morgans and I hook them up to the buggy and go for a drive. And especially if I do it regularly, which I don't enough, but they like the interaction. Yep. You know, I kind of have a kind of a theory about animals that they're, you know, whether it's a horse or whatever, they do like, you know, they came from the wild, and if they get too domesticated, they kind of just get blah. They like a little adrenaline rush every once in a while, you know, like a little pressure, a little something that gets them going. So I don't, you know, but I know what you mean. You know, if you kept reading the book, you wouldn't, maybe not because you feel like you're being abusing the horse, because you're not, but just because you're looking at the horse a different way than as something that you're doing something physical with, I guess, or an activity.
Yeah, that book's still sitting around here. One day I'll go, okay, I'm ready to finish the book. But yeah, it really kind of got me thinking about that. I think that was probably 4 years ago, and so in the last 4 years, I've probably really changed a lot about how I go about things with them, and I might be able to read that book and go, no, I'm quite happy doing what I'm doing now, because I'm, you know, I've gone probably a level deeper, or two, I may have caught up with that book now, but I haven't, you know, it did make me kind of stop and think, nah. The other thing it made me think is, I might not eat bacon anymore, and I love bacon, so yeah.
That's a hard one, bacon. Bacon's good.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I grew up on a farm where we had our own cow. We milked our own cow. We had our own chickens, and we had our own sheep, and we ate them, and they lived out in the pasture and tootled around until they didn't tootle around anymore. But you know what I mean? And so that's my background with consuming meat, you know, and it's... Yeah, that's another story in itself. But anyway, yeah.
Well, I would have trouble eating an animal that I raised. I would have trouble, you know, doing that as much as I love, you know, the food that I love.
Right.
And so it sometimes makes me feel a little guilty about it. But I just am not the person that can do the that part in the middle where you have to kill the animal I couldn't, I would have trouble doing that, but I wasn't raised that way. You know, I wasn't raised on a farm where we raised our own food. And the people that do, that are raised on a farm, like they have a relationship with the animals that they raise, you know, for food. And that's part of the relationship with them.
Yeah. It's a different way of looking at things. So getting back to the story of Jim Masterson. Okay. So yeah, you've got the Africa thing. What other cool stories have you got from Uganda? Because I'm sure if you were there for a couple of years, you saw some things do not see in like the cultures that we live in.
Well, yeah, you know, when we moved there, and I was 16 when we moved there, I think, yeah, right around there. And of course, it's a whole different culture, and you know, Africa's an interesting place. I remember, you know, thinking at one point, while you're there, sometimes depending where you are, you can't wait to get out. And then once you leave, you can't wait to go back again. So, but the Congo, was pretty backwards. We lived in a town in the Northern Congo, and it's all jungle up there. And my dad flew transports, you know, DC-3s and C-46s and sevens, around to different, there was a company that contracted pilots and maintenance crews for the Congolese Air Force. And so these were Congolese Air Force cargo planes. And so he would fly from Kisangani to these little airstrips all over the Northern Congo. And so me and my little brothers, that's what we did for 2 years. There was no school there. We just traveled around the Northern Congo and the Northeast Congo. We'd fly with my dad and land at some dirt strip at some little town that probably had an army base there. And then we'd get off the plane and we'd make our way back home. You know, it's probably maybe 300 miles or so, sometimes 4, on these dirt roads through the jungles, riding on trucks that used to take, you know, stuff between towns, food and things. And so it was a two-year education, you know, completely different than going to school. You know, you're with Africans, you know, and they're not the same as Europeans, especially in the Congo. There's a huge gap between Europeans and Americans and the locals, just the historical and cultural gap. So I think it's cool to be exposed to that as a teenager, because you don't really have a lot of judgment about it. You don't have a lot of history or baggage with that. You know, you're just, you recognize there's a difference, you know, the way the Europeans act towards the Africans and the way the Africans act and feel towards the Europeans. But, you know, there's a nice overlap in it, and there was no kind of fighting or anything going on at the time. It was between rebellions, and so you could get along, but there was a huge, you know, disparity in the way you live. But as a teenager, it was kind of neat because you didn't have any judgment about it, and you didn't have any hesitation to just go somewhere and be with them, you know, where you didn't worry about what it looked like, you know, associating with people of completely different race and culture. So, you know, I'm glad I did it. You know, I caught up on my regular education later. I didn't need it at the time.
Right. Well, that's the sort of education money can't buy.
No, you can't. It's not like a program
right.
that you can sign up for.
And you're probably lucky there to be in between rebellions too. So it was, you know, safe enough to travel around and do whatever you wanted to do. And
my parents, they've never been worriers, you know, no matter where we live. They never worried about, I kind of joke that, you know, they had eight kids, so they had a few spares, you know, if anything went wrong. But they never worried about it, and they just let us go off and do our thing as long as we were home for dinner. And I look back now, if I had kids, I'd be worried about, you know, them even here, you know, not danger-wise, but, you know, my nephew lives here in Fairfield, and he's my little brother's son, and my little brother passed away a few years ago, and so Evan's a teenager now, but I not worry about him being in danger. I just worry about him making the right decisions in life, you know? And so I try to steer him towards the right decisions without being controlling. But if we, you know, if he was my kid and he was younger and growing up, I don't think I'd feel comfortable with him running off into the jungle for 2 weeks
right.
and coming up and expecting him to show up at some point, you know?
You know, I did a clinic in Australia a few years ago, and there was a lady from South Africa in the clinic. And that night at dinner, I ended up sitting next to her, and I said, "How long have you been in Australia?" And she'd only been there a couple of years, or maybe 3 years. And I said, "So how do you like it?" And she goes, "Well," she said, "the energy is different here." And I was like, "So it's better?" She goes, "No, there's less of it." And I'm like, "Less what?" She goes, "Less energy." And I was trying to figure out what she was talking about. And she said, "Well, you know, I get off the plane in South Africa and I can feel the energy." And I said, "What do you think the difference is?" And she goes, "Oh, that," and she didn't even think about it. I said, "What do you think the difference?" She goes, "Oh, that's easy." She goes, "Every human and animal in Africa knows today's the day I could die."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. We take that for granted.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we kind of get numb to that. You know, we live in a safe society, you know, we choose not to live in the bad part of town, we have police, you know, everything's nice and orderly, but that's not really how nature works.
No, we assume things are going to be taken care of one way or another, you know, one way or another. And over there, you know, something as simple as a breaking a bone or a, you know, traffic accident, it could be, that could change your life, you know, for the worse. So it's true, you know, and that's a neat thing that is an energy in Africa. Like it is I know what she means. But I wouldn't probably have gotten off the plane and put it in those terms, but that, you know, that she did, but it's interesting that she just, that's what came out.
Yeah, there's something very primal about Africa. You know, I've been...
Primal is the word. That's when you get... Yeah, that describes it. It's primal.
And you said... And you know, you said...
The environment and the people. The people and the physical environment, nature. It's very primal.
Yeah.
Primal.
Yeah, you said, you know, when you're there, you probably can't wait to leave. And when you leave, you can't wait to go back. And I have heard that when you go to Africa, it kind of... It stays in you a little bit. And I've been once and can't wait to go back again because it's just amazing.
Yeah. Well, I've been back a few times working, you know, when I was in the oil field, I went back, worked in the Sudan for 4 months, and then I went back and was in Angola for a couple of years. So it was, but it was funny.
You can't just brush over that.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, it's funny because when I was working offshore, when I went to Angola for an offshore drilling company, and I went as a training coordinator to train Angolans to work on the rigs. And it's funny because I had grown up there for a few years and been there before, quite a bit before then. And nobody I worked with really, you know, they're all from the States, from the Gulf, you know, Gulf area, Louisiana, Texas. And they completely saw Africa as different than I did. You know, they were just going there for a job, and it was a headache, you know, having to deal with the Africans. And I saw them differently. I saw them as somebody people I was trying to help and help them get ahead and kind of get out of that rut they live in a rut, you know, cause they don't have the opportunity we have, and they don't have the protections we have. They can have, the culture's different, you know, like in Africa, if you get ahead, you know, there's a tribal culture. It's a smaller unit, you know, than a country that like the US, where we're all together. It's a small clan unit. And if you get ahead, you get ahead too far, somebody's going to come along and take what you've got, because that's the way it is. You know, you can't have that much more than somebody else. And, so it's hard for them to get ahead, so it's different. So anyway, I wanted to help them get ahead, and I was working with, you know, Americans, expats that they could care less whether they got ahead. They were over there to do their job and make a living.
I went to Kenya a couple of years ago, and I met a lady there who'd been a safari guide in Africa for 17 years. She's from England. Wow. Name's Emily. Mm-hmm. And Emily is also a licensed diesel mechanic. And so she was a safari guide, and she drove one of those big six-wheel drive trucks, and she's driven through every country in Africa, mm-hmm, except Angola. And when you see, yeah, reason she hasn't been to Angola, they wouldn't let her in at the border, but it's not safe to travel through. So when you said you spent 2 years in Angola, I'm like, my ears pricked up, like, really? That's one of the most dangerous places in Africa.
Well, it was between civil wars, you know. It was towards the end of the civil war. They were still fighting there, and we actually had to abandon a rig at one point because they were getting too close. But, we weren't being shot at or anything. It just says, but anyways, so it was Angola. They had a lot of, war going on for a long period of time. They were late to be given independence from Portugal, and there was a lot of fighting while they were trying to gain their independence. And then once they got their independence, there was, you know, the communist factions wanting, you know, and then the non-communist factions. And so there was a long civil war after they gained independence. It's finally, so that's probably why they wouldn't, you know, she couldn't, yeah, go in. And in the 60s, that's the way it was with the Congo. And then in the later, in the, I think the 80s, it was even, then it got bad too. So, you always kind of had to navigate. Well, yeah, ever since the 60s, when a lot of African countries got independence, you had to kind of navigate your way between the conflict areas if you were driving through Africa. And I remember those, she might have worked for these outfits that took these big Bedford trucks, you know, six-wheel drive trucks, and they would have a huge trailer with all their camping gear. And people would go on safari from Europe across the Sahara down through through the Congo, and then over to East Africa, and then on down to South Africa in these big trucks. And that's what made me, that's what I thought of when you said she was a diesel mechanic.
Yeah, that's what she did. She's
been
one of
through
those
every country, yeah, except Angola. I'm surprised she got through the Sudan too, because Sudan had so much fighting. And I worked there on a drilling rig for 3 months. My dad was flying over there in the oil field, and it was, you know, there was a period of, I don't know, it might have been 3 or 4 or 5 years where they weren't fighting, you know, the South wasn't fighting against the North. And so, you know, oil companies went in, and there was oil there, and the government wanted him to drill for oil. But then, you know, within a few years after I worked there, no, there wasn't any more drilling there because of fighting. But it's kind of cool. Now you can go on Google Maps and go to the places where you used to be. And I went on Google Maps to see, try to find where I was in the Southern Sudan on this rig, which was, there was no town there either. There were just a rig, and it was moving around drilling some wells. And I went on Google Maps, and I was able to see there actually is, they have produced some oil down there now. So again, not that that has to do with anything, but except that it's hot and cold is how Africa runs, you know.
Right. Wow, that's quite the stories I wasn't expecting to get out of Jim Masterson.
I don't talk about the monkeys a lot because, you know, I have a reputation to protect. You know, I work with horses, and then people might think, "What you mean? You learned about horses from monkeys? That can't work." But you know, there's a connection there.
So. You know what? I learned about humans from horses, so you know, you can learn. Mm-hmm. You can learn something.
One thing about you, I noticed, and I don't know you really well. I've just met you a few times, and I hear about you from, you know, the Masterson Method people that go to your clinics, and from Sandy, and that you're open. You're not just in that lane. You know, you change lanes and get back in your lane. You were talking about the psychologist, about the attunement, and you investigate different things that have to do. You know, it's not just about the horses; it's about the people. You know, a lot of horse world. It's about, you know, the horses, but for me, you know, with this work, with the body work, you know, that's the effect that it has on the people. And when somebody's doing that bladder meridian technique, which my goal is every horse on the planet have the bladder meridian done to it at least once. And because not just because it's going to make a huge impact on the horse as the way the horse sees the human or relates to the human, but it's going to make a really big impact on the person too. You know, we were talking about being present. Mm-hmm. You know, the horses, when you get a little instruction on how to be present with the horse, just doing the work, you get present with the horse because you're waiting for something. It's all, anything you do with horse, I've kind of come to look at it this way. If you were to just step back and give it, the horse, some time in between what you're doing, you'd be 10 times more effective with whatever you're doing with the horse. If you just gave the horse that space and see how it responded to what you're doing, it would make you present, but also it would make the horse more present with you. Because like we were talking about, once the horse gets that you get what they're saying, then it changes the relationship.
Yeah. And if you think about horses in a herd, you know, they're not mutually grooming each other 24 hours a day. They spend so much time just being. And what do we do? Yeah. Anytime we show up with a horse, there's something we want. There's something we want to do. And we just don't spend any time just hanging with them. And we've got our mare just had a foal. We've been gone for 3 weeks in Arizona, and our mare had a foal while we're gone. And since I've been back, I've only been back a couple of days, but I've been doing my morning meditation out there in that pasture with the foal. And that mare had a foal a couple of years ago. And that was the first foal I'd done everything completely differently than I used to do. And what we did with him was we didn't interact with him initially. We'd go out there and sit and let him come and interact with us, but not try to touch him, not try to control him, not try to do anything with him for 3 or 4 months, really. And he's the friendliest horse in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's two now, but he'll be out there in the pasture in knee-high grass eating, and you'll walk out there and he'll pull his head out of the grass and come up every single time. The older horses might just stay there, but he comes up every time. And this foal of ours, just going out there and being around them without asking for something. So that's kind of like my first thing now, whether it's with any horse really, but like with this one, you think about the first interactions with foals are usually we're going to do something to them, we're going to touch them, we want to touch them, we want to do this with them, we want to whatever, and that's their their first interaction with humans. And it's amazing how inquisitive about you they get if you can just not ask anything of them. And so I think, you know, the Masterson thing I went to with Sandy, some of those people there I think probably have never really been present before. And so you see these huge things. I spent a year doing a type of therapy called dialectical behavior therapy about 3 years ago, both individual therapy and group therapy. But one, and they used to give us homework, like mindfulness homework in this therapy. And one of the homework suggestions was closely observe an animal. Like if your cat's laying on the windowsill and the sun's coming, and just sit there and just look at the sun coming off every little hair on the cat. And what are you doing with the Masterson method? You are closely observing an animal. And that's very, I don't know if that's the healing part, but it opens you up to all sorts of stuff. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more to it than just the poor stuff.
Yeah, it's actually pretty sneaky because that's a byproduct of treating the horse, you know. And because you're just it's observing, you know. I use the bladder meridian as an example because you become mindful through the process of doing that, you know, because you're part of the process is to wait just once you get that response. So, you know, you have a goal and you want to see what's going on with the horse, and then you get a response. And so then you stay with that and do nothing and wait, but you're waiting for something to happen. But while you're waiting for something to happen, your mind calms way down and you become present. And then you get the payoff when the horse gives you this big yawn, you know, then like, it's like, anyways, yeah, I know what you mean, but you mentioned you meditate and which helps, you know, and I learned transcendental meditation when I was younger. So, you know, I had it.
Don't pass over that one. Tell us all about learning TM.
Yeah. So, well, after I got out of high school and I went to Alaska to Fairbanks, and I was there for 4 years. And a friend of mine up there, he had learned TM, and he said, you really need to learn this. And since he was a really good friend of mine, and I, you know, did everything he said, he was kind of like a mentor of mine up there. He was living up there and said, come on up. So I learned, and you know, you get that experience of that silence and you get comfortable with it. And so, at least you recognize it later on in life. Now, one of the early, you know, after I learned, I said, man, this is so cool. My hangovers aren't nearly as bad now after I learned to meditate. But, you know, that wasn't because I was young and having fun. But so I meditate. I don't meditate regularly now, but I can sit down and meditate. And you start to get that quality in your activity, active life, too, when you meditate.
Then you don't have to meditate because everything's a meditation.
Yeah, everything's meditation, but it's good to meditate because, you know, it's good to kind of calm your nervous system down and get it reminded, you know. It's good when you start to recognize that you can have that quality of silence at a certain level in activity, you know. It still is good to meditate because you really get it and it reminds you because, you know, I get stressed out with, you know, the business and keeping things going and doing all these new things. And then you get caught up in that being stressed out and it's hard to break that cycle. But if you know how to meditate, you can at least sit down and at least break that cycle.
You know, it's funny you said once you learn how to meditate, then your hangovers became less. Well, mine did too, because once I, about 2 years into meditating, I lost the desire to drink anymore, so my hangovers went away because I didn't drink.
Yeah, so your hangovers got a lot better. Yeah,
my hangovers got a lot better because I wasn't drinking anymore.
Yeah. Well, I like beer. I just like beer, and I have wine with dinner, but I don't, you know, I wouldn't call a heavy drinker. But, you know, when I was younger, you know what it's like. You're out partying and having fun, and life's an adventure, and but, you know, I recognize the quality of meditation, but it was kind of half joking with him that when he asked me one time, how do you like it? You know, how's it going? I said, that was my response because it was kind of just being glib. But, I think the thing about meditating is in TM that you want to integrate, it integrates into the rest of your life. It's just not about the 20 minutes you sit and meditate. It's about how it integrates, it changes throughout the rest of the day. It has an effect on that.
So I've got a question for you. Were you the only roughneck in the world who does TM? Because it's the two don't really go together.
Yeah, but I think I'm the only one that I ever ran into. I don't know if there might, it's a big world out there, but I would have to, you know, on an offshore rig, it was a 4 week on, 4 week off schedule. So when I was meditating more in those days, when I was younger, I would, on my 12 hours, you know, it's 12 on, 12 off, for 28 days, 12 hours on, 12 hours off. So you take your shower, you go to the mess hall or the dining room, you eat, you know, as much as you can eat. And then you and your buddies on the crew might go watch a movie or something in the TV room, or they might go play poker. I don't play poker, but I would kind of have to sneak off and find a quiet place where I could sit and meditate, where people wouldn't ask me what I was doing. Because
right.
If you'd say, oh, I'm meditating, all of a sudden you're labeled like a guru or something. Right. And they're just, so I'd have to sneak off and find a place to meditate. And I'd have a book in my lap. And so if somebody came and said, what are you doing? I said, oh, I must have fallen asleep. I was reading my book.
You've got to have a cover up for your meditation. So for people who are not familiar with TM, Transcendental Meditation, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's been around a while. There are a lot of different ways to meditate. I think they all have the goal of being mindful and quieting the mind down. TM was a way of meditating brought from India by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in the 50s, in the late 50s. And then in the 60s, it kind of really took off in the U.S. And because he developed just a simple system of meditating, sitting down 20 minutes twice a day. And when you get taught, you get a mantra, which is just a sound to kind of repeat in your mind until your mind settles down. And then the benefits, he had a lot of research done on it, you know, the physiological benefits. It quiets the nervous system down. It creates coherence in the brain waves. So he had a lot of research done. He was a monk, but he before he became a monk, he was a physics student. I think he had a master's in physics in India. So he came at it from a scientific perspective too, because he wanted to study the physical benefits and the mental benefits of meditation, not just the, you know, the spiritual aspect of meditation. So he came at it from a very scientific approach. But he still had long hair and wore a robe. You know, he looked like a yogi from India. But it really took off, and a lot of people in Hollywood. The Beatles went to India. The number of actors in Hollywood that have learned to meditate over the years, a lot of them in the 60s and 70s, is like a mile long. You wouldn't even know. Clint Eastwood is a big, big meditator. And
really?
Yeah. Oprah, Jim Carrey. You know, Merv Griffith. Is that it? Yeah, he was big on TM. He used to have personalities who were into TM on his show. So in the 70s and 80s especially, and I learned in the 70s. But it just took off. It's just a system of meditation, and it's still around. And I live in Iowa now, and how I ended up here is because I don't want to open another page, but when I left Alaska, I went to Wyoming because my dad had gotten a job there flying fire retardant bombers. And so the pipeline was over. I was ready to leave Alaska. So I went down to Wyoming and lived there for a few years. And after I was there for 2 years, and then my dad upped and got a job in Libya. So my mom and dad and my little sister took off to Europe again. And then I stayed on in Wyoming. And when I was ready to leave Wyoming, my friend from Alaska had moved to Fairfield because the TM movement had bought a college campus here and started a college in Fairfield, Iowa. So I came out here from Wyoming and stayed a couple of years and came and went, met my wife here. She's from the East Coast, and she came from a meditating family.
Really?
But anyways, so there's a huge TM community here in Fairfield, Iowa, because of the college, the university. And so that's how I ended up here in Fairfield. I forgot what my point was, but I'm sure it was profound.
Well, my point has been, I didn't have a point, but my point has been taken care of, because in this conversation, what I wanted to do was figure out How the bloody hell did Jim Masterson figure out the stuff he's figured out? Well, now I know. Like, it's not like you were some average Joe and this stuff just came to you. I mean, you've been doing transcendental meditation since the 70s and you moved to Fairfield, Iowa to immerse yourself in it. Now, it all makes sense now. And you've lived in Africa, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And been with the primates. And it's like, okay, well, that's how you stumbled upon it. You didn't stumble upon it. You spent 30 years preparing yourself
for it.
Okay. Now,
all those things have an influence. Well, everybody, you know, it's the same with everybody. You know, I just maybe had a little broader range of different influences, but I'm sure meditating helped me learn. You know, when I was grooming horses and I was watching therapists work on the horses, I was able to just observe, you know, without my brain getting in the way. Not that I wasn't thinking. I'm watching a massage therapist work on a horse or a horse chiropractor, and I'm watching these changes in the horse's behavior. It's not like I was meditating, but you know, I was able to just observe, you know, and not feel like I was missing something or I didn't know something or I should be more educated. And I kind of joke that, I was able to just, you know, when I, for example, the bladder meridian, I use that as an example. So you run your hand lightly down this line, that it's a Chinese medicine meridian that runs along the top line on each side of the horse. And I don't know Chinese medicine, but these massage therapies, these two ladies that were massaging our trainer hired them in out of Estes Park at a show to work on our horses. And they would relax the horse by doing the bladder meridian, just running their finger really lightly down this meridian of the horse and just to relax the horse and kind of connect with the horse. And I noticed the horse would blink at certain points and I could see the horse was feeling something there. So when I went to do it, I would run my finger over this down the line. And if I got a blink, and you did this at the weekend, you got a blink, you would stop, wait, and do nothing and just keep the horse's attention, awareness on that until it started to release, you know. So you search for the response, you stay on that spot until you get a release. And the stay part's the hardest part, to wait and wait and wait until something happens. And I kind of joke, I'm naturally lazy. So that part was easy for me to wait and just do nothing. And then the other part is once I wasn't trained to massage that place, or I wasn't trained to do anything. So I didn't have any training in the way. So I was uneducated and lazy. So those two things were a huge advantage I had over people that are trained and want to get things done, you know? So,
yeah.
But having meditated, it's easier to wait and see what happens and observe. So,
right. You just said so.
That's actually what you're doing when you're meditating. You reach this point where you're just witnessing what's going on in your mind rather than being caught up in it. You're kind of take a step away from it. So you're right. It's kind of all those things kind of came together in a way. And I wouldn't have gone to work with horses if I hadn't have been in Fairfield, because that's where my wife said, go to work for Val, she needed a groom to go on the road with her to the shows. She had grooms at home. I didn't want to, you know, clean stalls at home. I wanted to just go on the road with her to the shows and take care of the horses. So that's how I got into the horses work or competing level.
Okay. Well, our podcast is done. I got the mystery, because I'm kidding. Okay. Well, my podcast is not done, but that's what I was trying to dig out was how do you get there? But speaking of jokes, made me think of a joke while you were telling your stories there. Here's a joke. Made it up. This is a dad joke, but I'm good at dad jokes.
Okay.
What does Clint Eastwood say when he sits down to do transcendental meditation?
Make my day.
Go ahead. Make me present. Sorry, that's a dad joke, but I could just see Dirty Harry doing that. Go ahead. Make me present.
Yeah, it's the other side of Dirty Harry.
That's crazy. I didn't know that Clint Eastwood was a meditator. So tell me a bit about... So you went to work, you were a groom for one person, is that correct? Like one owner?
Well, the trainer, there were two or three families in here in town who were into horses, and they wanted to show, you know, their daughters wanted to show, and a couple of the parents showed when they were younger. So they were successful business family people and men. And so they bought a horse farm here, and they hired a trainer, and to go show on the road. You know, they started, excuse me, in the Midwest here, you know, going to shows around here in Chicago and St. Louis and Columbia, Missouri, you know, showing around here. And they had really nice horses, you know, and it was a really nice operation. Hunter Jumper, you know, at that level is pretty nice. And then she started going farther afield out to, you know, Lake Placid, and, you know, we go to Lexington a couple times a year and out to Estes Park for the spring show. And then eventually ended up down going to Ocala, which is the next step before Wellington. Yep. You know, Ocala is pretty big time, but Wellington's like the big time. And so they ended up showing down in Wellington. And so we would go down for the season down in December. And that's where I really started to pick up on this. The thing that kind of got me interested was there was an old horse chiropractor from New Zealand who lived in California that the vets would bring out to, you know, Lexington and Florida to adjust their clients' horses, you know, a few times a year. And when he came out, he'd been doing it for 40 years, and he'd learned from another old guy in New Zealand who'd been doing it for 40 years. And he used very long lever, forceful techniques, but he got amazing results. And he would read the horse. After he did an adjustment, he would step back to see what the horse had to say. And if he got a good adjustment, the horse would maybe stagger a little or blink a few times and shake its head and then start yawning repeatedly. And that was his sign he got a good adjustment. And then, so whenever he came out and he would come to our barn at the shows to do, you know, to work on our horses, we would have anywhere from like 4 to maybe 8 horses at the shows. And I just followed him around. I was fascinated. I wanted to do what he did. I wanted to become a horse chiropractor and adjust horses and get amazing results and fix everybody's horse, you know, and make it go better. And but that intrigued me, that horse, you know, seeing what the horse had to say. And there was another thing that happened that helped me make that connection. At Estes Park at the show, Val, our trainer, hired these two ladies to massage our horses, and they did traditional massage, and they would start with the bladder meridian, like I was describing. And so when I started experimenting with the bladder meridian, and I got a blink, and I just waited there to see what happened, put no pressure on the horse, actually maybe less pressure, then the horse would drop its head, start to lick and chew, and sometimes would start yawning repeatedly, you know, and the eyelid would roll back just from doing that. So there's a connection there. The horse was releasing something. Something was happening. And so that was the connection, you know, that really got me going. And so I would follow this horse chiropractor around whenever he came around. And when I was starting to, you know, build my business down in Wellington, when I stopped grooming and started just trying to pick up horse clients while I was down there. I would drive the horses down there for Val, and then I would go off and do my own thing for the season, then come and drive them back. So that was kind of my ticket down there. But anyways, I would follow him around and hold the lead rope and drive him from barn to barn for a couple of trips that he came down there and just watch. And he didn't share, you know, he didn't want to teach anybody. You know, he was old timer, you know, he played his cards close to his chest. But I would just pick up little things, and I would ask him little questions, and he would give me an answer. And he was a really nice guy. And I wanted to apprentice with him, and he said, you know, it won't work. You know, he didn't train people. So I just picked up some things from just like two or three key things that really made a huge difference. And I started adding movement techniques into the way I work on horses. And so I kind of learned what movement the horse needed and what parts of the body to make an improvement, to make a change. But rather than using force, I would use softening. Like, you know, you did a technique on your weekend where lateral cervical flexion, where you go down the neck and you're asking for relaxed movement of each vertebra down the neck. And as you work your way down and soften, if you run into tension in a vertebra or the connective tissue of a junction, if there's tension in there and you ask it to move, then the horse tenses, the horse braces against it because it's uncomfortable. So when the horse braces, if you soften, it's counterintuitive rather than tense. You know, usually when the horse tenses, we tense. when the horse tenses, you soften, the horse releases some of that tension. And then you can move through it. You, all of a sudden, you can move through it. So I would take something, an adjustment that he would use, a very long lever and a lot of pressure to get his adjustment. And I would do the opposite. I would soften at that point, and the horse would release the tension. And so, it's good that he didn't want to train me, because otherwise I'd be doing something
long
different.
Stuff. You know, and
not only that, you can't teach that to everybody, and you can teach what I'm doing to everybody. Anybody can learn how to do this. You know, some people might take a little longer to learn. You know, it's counterintuitive to let go rather than try to do something. So,
you know, I think the difference with what you do than almost every other body worker, if that's what you are, does is I think that you release the mental tension that's causing the physical tension, whereas other people are working on the physical tension, but the reason it's there is still there. And, the, you know, like they're still holding on to that mental tension, which causes that physical tension. And that's the thing. I think a big part of what you do is, like what you said, get to that point where they start to tighten up and you, instead of pushing through it, you relax a little bit. That's that attunement. That's telling them, I see your threshold. And these days, absolutely, I'm all about staying below threshold. And it's I mentioned before, there's a trauma therapist from Canada, and she's the one that said attunement is the sense of being seen, being heard, feeling felt, and getting gotten. And she wrote some really good blogs. She's got a website called Equisoma. But one of her blogs on there was, I forget what the wording was, but she was basically saying, letting them know you see things before you worry about trying to get results. I forget exactly how she worded it. I'll probably put it in the show notes or something. Something before concepts, communication before concepts or something like that, she said. But basically, anytime they start to tense up, tell them, okay, saw that. You're not trying to get a result. You're trying to...
I wonder if I heard that might have been part of one of your demonstrations at one of the expos, because that sounds really familiar, and it made sense to me that made sense to me at the time, and it makes sense now.
I'm looking it up right now so I can give you the real rundown on what it.
It's almost like it's really about the horse. It's not about what you're thinking.
Connection before concepts. That's what she says. Connection before concepts. So if they say that scares me, you go, well, I saw that, rather than trying to solve the problem or that bothers me.
Right.
Instead of trying to fix why it bothers them, you've got to say, I saw it bothered you. And what I found I used to do a lot of desensitizing with horses. Desensitizing, trying to get them to where they wasn't bothered by it. These days, I still do, but it's not desensitizing. You start doing something, if they say that bothers me, you take it away immediately.
Yeah.
That's that communication, that connection thing. And guess what?
Right.
It works exactly the same way. It's where after a while, the thing doesn't bother them, but they are so much more relaxed, and it builds trust in you. It builds connection. It's just like, for me, it's like the holy grail. And to the average person looking over the fence, they'd probably think you're an idiot.
Yeah. I get exactly what you mean. It's like, you know, you're wiggling your way down the neck and you feel the horse start to tense and you immediately soften. Sometimes you feel it before it even happens and you soften, and then the horse softens right away. And then it's like they get that you're not going to push through that point. So you can desensitize them by pushing through that point until they get used to it. But the way you're describing it is you're not pushing through that point. You're letting them know, okay, that's the threshold. Because you got to find the threshold to release tension. You got to find where it is. And to get the horse desensitized, you got to find where that threshold is. But when you get to that threshold, that's when you soften. And then that's the connection with the horse she's talking about before the concept of, let's get this out of here. You know, let's get you desensitized. Let's get you used to this. That's been done for ages, right? But this is just a different way to do it. And you get good results from it, and I get good results from it. And it, I think it's better than with the horse's nervous system. We're working with the, like you said, the mental. It's the part of the nervous system. When the horse releases the tension, it's a lot deeper and it lasts longer than when you make the tension go away.
Yeah, well, I think when you make the tension go away, you've like I said before, you've fixed the physical problem, but the reason it's there is because they're holding onto some mental tension. And it's funny, when I first became aware of your work, and it was about the same time that I was doing things quite a bit differently and starting to, you know, observe different results, you know, the yawning, the third eyelid rolling back. And every once in a while, I would have a horse have such a big release that their nose would run, like they just have a big old out of both nostrils. And then I think I was talking to you at the Western States Horse Expo in Sacramento, and you said that you observed the same thing. And it's, you know, it's like they've been holding on to stuff in there, and
when you release tension in the pole and the atlas up there, and all of a sudden their nose starts draining, but it makes sense to me. You know, that's mental tension, mm-hmm. but it's mental that's turned into physical tension. And then when it lets go, and that's one of the things that whole horse chiropractor pointed out to me, you know, because I noticed it when he was doing adjustments, and he said, yeah, so, oh, that makes sense. And it's usually when you're working up in this area, but sometimes you're working somewhere else on the horse, and all of a sudden their nose starts to drain. And the value of that is that, oh, it's working. Sometimes you don't think it's working. You think, well, how can this be working? I'm not doing it. I didn't get that because the horse didn't like it. Well, the horse didn't like it because you found it. But then when you backed off, the horse let some of that go. So when you see the nose running, then you know you're making progress, and you don't feel like you have, oh, I better do more. It's not working. So a lot of people, you know, we teach people how to do this now. So we're observing people as much as horses, but that it's a common thing that, you know, they feel like they need to do more. And I do that too. You know, and when I work on horses, I have to remind myself, wait a minute, this is having a pretty huge effect on this horse. That's why this horse has just stopped responding, because he's overloaded. His nervous system's overloaded. Time to back off. But as humans, we want to keep doing it because it's good. It's working. We want to keep going, or it's not working. I better work harder at it. And then the horse has reached his point where he can't do anymore. So you notice these things that tell you what's working, and you don't feel so much like you have to do more.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. And so I think we better get to some of these questions that you've chosen here, because I I've got to I wanted to know how Jim Masterson figured this out, but now I know, because all your other stuff. You know, I've got a...
It was kind of a revelation. The clouds opened up and this big beam of light came down.
You know, I've got a friend of mine in Texas who trains reining horses at a very, very, very high level. But he looks at things so much differently than everybody else does. And I've known him for quite a long time. But I think we used to have those superficial conversations. And as I've gone down the rabbit hole, we've started having some different conversations. But he told me here 6 months ago, and I've known him for 20 years, that when he was younger, I knew he worked on a Arabian place. But the people that owned the place, you just told me this 6 months ago, people that owned the place were really into meditation and stuff. And they used to have like mantra meditations, and they had these affirmations and all this stuff. And he did that for several years, 20 or 30 years ago, probably, when he was working for them. And he'd never mentioned it. But this guy's just got this, like, everybody loves him because he's just got this cool vibe about him or whatever. And I didn't even know that bit about him. And it's kind of like I was trying to figure out how Jim Masterson figured this stuff out, and that all that stuff, living in Africa, the transcendental meditation, it all adds up to
it. Well, that stuff doesn't fit in with our traditional concept of, you know, a cowboy or a horseman or whatever. But when you look back at, like, the Dorrances, you know, I didn't know them, but I read about them, and, you know, the way they were with horses was just kind of like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Very, very present. But see, I don't think they had to be
very present
to be present, because they didn't grow up in this technological world we have, where we're glued to our phones and stuff. And I think that's the difference, is is a lot of people, me especially, in the beginning reading anything that Dorrance just read, I'm like, I don't understand a word they said. But as I've gotten further along now, it makes a lot more sense. But anyway, let's ask Jim some questions. Jim Masterson, what is your biggest failure and how has it helped you?
So I liked that question because it wasn't like I had a huge failure where I felt like, you know, life was over and it made a huge, you know, epiphany or anything. It's almost like, you know, I was talking about, I wanted to do what this guy did, the horse chiropractor. And when he said, no, just, he did encourage me to go on and keep messing with it. But, you know, to me, it was a huge letdown. And, but it turned out that that was the, you know, that it worked out better for me that way. But also it's, I think it's a neat question because, you know, we have little failures every day. You know, we have things every day that, you know, and I'm coming at this from kind of a teaching point of view with students or people that come to learn this, that, oh, that's not working. Oh, that's not working. Oh, that's not working. And I'm not getting it when really they're getting it, you know, they're getting it. And it's hard to get people to get, they're getting it. That's, it's hard to do that. So that's kind of a, I thought that was a good question because, you know, we get discouraged easily because we're not, and some people are more perfectionist or A-type personalities than other, and they get discouraged because, oh, it's not working. So they try harder, they tense up and you know, those are little failures that, you know, the daily that we feel like we're failing at, and it's easy to get discouraged. But that question, you know, I thought that's how it related to that. That did bring up, you know, that I wanted to be what this guy was. But actually this is better because I'm able to, you know, teach, you know, tons more people how to experience this and their horses to experience it too.
Yeah, well, I thought I wanted to be a reining horse trainer for about 20 years and kept trying to do it. You know.
Well, you weren't a failure at it, though.
Well, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a world beater. So, but that's, you know, these questions are from Tim Ferriss's book, Tribe of Mentors. So he sent these 20 questions out to all these people and all their email results. He turned it into a book. What I really like about that question is, and you kind of touched on a minute ago, is I like the fact that it helps people understand that failure is part of success and not to go, oh, God, I'm failing. Like, yeah, another failure. That's good. And I'm a big fan of a book called Mastery by George Leonard. I don't know if you've ever read that one, but it talks about the plateau. So when you're learning something new, you get a bit of an increase in knowledge and then it drops off a bit and then you're on this plateau for a long time. And I'll draw you a little picture here. You know, so you go up and you go down, and then you're on this plateau for a long time before you get enough skill to have another upward surge. And most people think we're on the plateau that they're failing, they're not getting anywhere. But you have to understand that's a part of the learning process. And you kind of touched on it when you said people think they're not getting it where they are getting it. And it's kind of like people that first try to meditate and they go, oh, I can't meditate. And I like to tell them, well, Eckhart Tolle says, when you realize you're not present, you're present. And the only reason you think you can't meditate is because you realized you weren't thinking about your breathing or your mantra or whatever it was. And at that very instant when you said, I can't meditate, you were actually meditating. So because you're aware of that you were not focusing on your breath or your mantra or whatever it is you're supposed to be focusing.
But that's a good lesson, you know, the plateau idea, because you feel like you're not going anywhere, but you are going somewhere. It's part of the process, and you get discouraged with the plateau, like I'm not, especially when it's a long plateau. And but there's a reason for that, you know, that's leading up to whatever's next. I think that's the value of, you know, that concept of the plateau, and the fun part's where you're learning.
Right. Yeah, the fun part is when you get the upward surge because you think you're getting somewhere. But I think the plateau provides us with two different things. One is it's where you're learning, but the other one, it's the test. It's like, how bad do you want this? You know, if you're if you're really into instant gratification, you'll give up during the plateau. And I think, and I like building stuff, because training horses is not an instant gratification pursuit. You don't see the changes right away.
Yeah.
I love to be able to, you know, work for 2 hours and stand back and look at something and go, yeah, that's what I got to accomplish. Well, you don't get that with horses. So that's why I like to build things just to satisfy that part of me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. That, you know, one of your questions was, what do you, you know, do for in your off time or as recreation? But it's, you know, I used to think I wouldn't have the patience to be a horse trainer, because you got to really build on each thing, and that, and you're, it's a long-term thing. You know, I realized at one point that every time we do something with a horse, we're training the horse, whether we know it or not. So if you want to, you got to be aware of what the horse is picking up from you. But the body work was easier for me to, because I got results right away. You know, I got a release right away. You get results as you're doing the work. You see the horse's responses and releases. So you, and then you get results afterwards in the in movement. So I think that's how, you know, the body work kind of filled that need for me, because it wasn't a long term thing. And I get, when you're training horses, you really have to have the patience. But you know, I developed patience from working on horses. You know, earlier on, I would get angry at them because, you know, it wasn't going right, and they weren't reacting the way I wanted them to react, or they were really uncomfortable with it. So they would, of course, you know, they're going to say no, but they do everything for a reason. And once I got that, I didn't take it personally. They weren't just doing it to me. You know, they were doing it for a reason, and I wasn't paying attention to what the reason was. So I learned patience from them in that respect.
Yeah, I think once you realize it's not a no, it's a threshold, it's a admission of their threshold, then it's a bit different. Yeah.
Yeah. You look at it differently, and So.
Okay. So next question, what has changed? What have you changed in the past 3, 4, or 5 years that have?
Well, that's interesting, because that was what we were just talking about, you know, learning how to be patient. I wrote down slow way down and at least try to stop judging, you know, judging the horse. You know, it's not easy, you know, it's always going to come up for us. But first is slow way down. I've slowed, when I stopped working on horses and, you know, stopped going on the show circuit and focus more on this teaching business. And then I would just work on horses in the course of teaching, you know, and going out and doing our clinics and our advanced courses. And I slowed down, way down, and I got much better results slowing down and waiting more during the
work.
You
know, I was just thinking of the parallel between what you're doing and what I'm doing, because I used to train horses for people, used to work on horses for people. Now you teach people how to work on horses, and I teach people how to train horses. And exactly the same thing. I've slowed way down and got much better results.
Yeah, much better results. And the other thing that it's kind of, I didn't have trouble with this early on, because this other thing that kind of has to do with this, when I started doing this work with horses, I was used to, like, the horse people I was around when I was a kid is like they all knew everything about horses, and they'd been around horses their whole life, and you couldn't teach them anything. And I thought these were the people that were going to show up at my clinics, like challenging, you know, what I was saying, that's not the way it's done. And they didn't show up. Only the people, everybody that showed up at my seminars that I was teaching, they were there to learn. And it was a little different than what they were normally used to. So it was different enough that they didn't want to challenge it, probably because it was working. But, we still have the need to be right. You know, we want to know what it is, and we want to, you know, with horses, we want to be the one that knows how to fix this or how to train that. And it, once you let go of that need to be right, it opens a whole new door. You know, you just observe and see what happens. So you kind of get what I'm saying?
Oh yeah. That, you know, that whole need to be right and to have all the answers and all that stuff.
But I was never going to be, I told myself, never going to be one of those guys that, oh yeah, I know how to fix that. I know what that is. You know, whether it's a chiropractor or a trainer or whatever, I was not going to be the guy that says, yeah, I know how to fix that. Because that's just your ego getting in the way, and it's not serving the person who's hiring you, or that it might be fooling the person that's hired you, but it's not going to fool the horse. So
I used to know how to fix stuff.
Yeah.
These days I'm like, I'll have a go with the information I have and where I'm at, and we'll see what happens. But
you're actually going to fix more things if you don't have that. Well, it's a thing in our teaching is like, you're not trying to fix anything in the horse. You're just trying to make an improvement with the body work. Each thing you do with the horse, you're not trying to fix anything, because when you have that intention that you're trying to fix something, the horse picks up on it and they internally brace against it. You know, it's like you're crossing the threshold with your intention, and the horse picks up on it, and then you're going to brace against it. You're not going to be paying attention to the horse. You're just going by what in your mind you think needs to be done. I think you talked about this a little earlier, the concept before the connection. So if you have this attitude, you're trying to fix something, then the horse picks up on it, at least when you're doing the physical work, and then they internally brace against it. So you have to just have the operating system is more like, we're just trying to make an improvement, and then we move on. Don't try to keep working on that spot. And that serves the horse better too, because their nervous system has to have time to process whatever you just released. So you're just trying to make an improvement, then you move on, and then you come back and you make another improvement, and then you move on. And that need to fix something is kind of like the need to be right. You know,
you just mentioned intention there, and I had a post on my Facebook group the other day, and this lady came on and she started saying how she followed this other horseman's program and it didn't work. And she mentioned who the other horseman was, and I will hear in a second. But I went to delete it because I don't, you don't trash talk other professionals who were doing a good job. Anyway, but as I read it further down, I left the whole thing there because she said, I tried to do Pirelli for 5 years and Pirelli didn't work with my horse. And so then I tried something else. And then she says, and then at some point in time, I realized it wasn't that Pirelli didn't work. My intention while doing Pirelli stuff didn't work. And then she said, I realized my intention at the time doing anybody's stuff wouldn't have worked. And so it's not it's not the techniques. And, you know, if her post had been different, I would have deleted it, but it wasn't picking on anybody, you know, it wasn't saying anybody was doing anything wrong. And then it was kind of, she was just expressing a revelation that she had. Like, I thought that Pat stuff didn't work with my horse. Mm-hmm. And then she realized it was just my intention behind it.
Yeah. Well, that was insightful to, you know, for her to pick up on that.
That's why I left it there, because I thought it was a good post for people to share, because I don't let people put down other trainers, because I think everybody's doing a great job. And another thing about intention I really had an epiphany about recently was in Bill Dorrance's book that Leslie Desmond wrote, True Horsemanship Through Feel, right in the very, very start, first page, I think, maybe page two, he's talking about feel, and he says, now, a foal can be laying down and a mare can brush the foal with her whiskers, and that feel that she offers can mean get up, we've got to go. Or it could mean everything's okay, stay down there, depending on the intention she presents it with. And I'm like, and I've read that book before and it didn't make sense to me, but I skipped things like that. It's like, oh, so actually the book could be called True Horsemanship Through Intention. That's a part of feel, is your intention. I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense now. But yeah, the presentation, the you know, something as subtle as brushing their whiskers on the foal while it's laying down could mean two totally opposite things, depending on the energy that was behind it. And I think that's why, like, say, meditating and things like that, getting people to change their internal world, I think it helps change that.
When you approach the horse, you know, some people approach the horse and the horse goes like this, and another person approaches the horse and the horse stays relaxed because your intention isn't. And it's hard, you know, like, but then somebody might ask, well, what intention should I have? Well, you know, how do you can't explain that too easily. Maybe don't have the intention that you're going to just make the horse do something. You might be able to explain that. But another way to look at it is, if it's not working, with the horse, then you're something wrong with your the way you're doing it. So maybe your intention should change. And the one example I use is, you know, when I go to pick up a horse's foot, I just step in and I put my hand down by the leg and I say, give me your foot. And it's not because the horse understands English, because it might be an Arabian or it might be an Andalusian. That maybe it speaks Spanish. I don't know. But but I'm clear on my intention. And a lot of people that go to pick up the foot, and they've been doing it this way their whole life, their intention is I'm gonna have to squeeze the flexor tendon, or I'm gonna have to yank on the foot, or he's gonna, you know, they think their intention is they want to pick up the foot, but part of that intention is I wonder how much trouble I'm gonna have picking up the foot. And when you say, give me your foot, you're clear on your intention and the horse picks up on it. And I mean, the majority of the time when I pick up a horse's foot, he picks up his foot for me just when I put my hand down there, because I'm clear on my intention and I'm clear because I say, give me your foot. So as an example, you know, we sometimes think our intention is one thing, but, you know, we're expecting something different.
Wise words there.
But another thing that's kind of funny, when I used to pick up the hind foot when I was working out, when I used to pick up, I realized I was saying the wrong thing. I would reach down for the hind foot and I'd say, let me have it. And then I remember, I thought one day, that's probably not the right choice of words when you're going to pick up the horse's hind foot. Let me have it.
They might give it to you.
So I changed it to give me your foot.
Okay. So what's a common myth about your line of work that you'd like to debunk?
Well, you know, when we work on the horse, it's about the whole, there's a lot of interconnections in the horse's body. And it's that thing of, that goes back to trying to fix something. So I'm going to fix this. And it's almost always never just one thing, you know, from the point of view of the body, the horse's body, it's not, oh, that's the atlas is out. That's the problem. That's part of the problem. And so if the atlas is out, there's going to be something else going on in the body that's out too. That's like, say the horse is jammed up in the right pole and atlas. Well, you can fix that, but what about the left hind on the diagonal? There's going to be some tension on the left hind too. In most cases, there are patterns, you know, when I first recognized there are patterns in the horse, and I kind of picked up on this from the old horse chiropractor, but there are patterns of tension. And that was the first indication that it's never just one thing. There's something connected to another thing, connected to another thing. So, to not have that mindset that, if I fix this, everything's going to be fine. Well, it may be a little better, but if you release the whole horse, we always do the whole horse, maybe not all at once, but we look at it like you're not just going to work on, he's got a neck problem. Every time you work on them, you got to do the rest of the body in order for all the rubber bands to kind of come back into alignment. So just to have that perception, or have that in mind, that it's almost always never just one thing. There's one thing that's connected to another. And then you don't have that attitude of, I'm just trying to fix this thing. You know, does that make sense?
Well, you know, yeah, exactly. Yeah. One thing.
It's just a way to look at the horse from, at least from the bodywork point of view, and the physical issues in the horse, that you know, you got to look at the whole horse together and not just as a problem here and a problem there. And, you know, vets are trained to treat issues. You know, they're trained to find what's wrong and treat it. And then, okay, now you go on out, and if it's better, good. But, you know, the horse's body might be compensating for a cough and joint issue, which is causing him pain. He's compensating, so he's going to start to build up tension in other parts of the body. So, you know, you can treat the leg, the foot, or leg, or whatever. But if you don't, sometimes they're still going to be on and off afterwards, and it's because of something else going on. Like, for example, you know, if they have something going on in the right front and they're compensating over time before they actually go lame, they're going to get jammed up in the lower neck and C7 on the left and T1. And so it's happened quite a few times with me that I've worked on a horse that recently had a cough and joint injected, and he was sound, and then he's off again, and he's sound, and he's off again, and then you release the tension in this junction here, and then all of a sudden they're good. So it has a practical value, you know, that looking at the horse that way, but also I think in general looking at things in a more holistic way is going to make your life easier with horses and their life easier with humans.
Surely is. Okay, next question for Jim Masterson. This is the one almost everybody picks. What is your relationship like with fear?
Okay, I like that one because when you sent that question, it's like most people would like to say, I'm like a Navy SEAL. I run into the jaws of death and then confront my fears. And to be honest, I don't, you know. I deal with them on a daily basis, you know. It's almost like, you know, some people, they're like that. They just confront, but I don't. It's like as if it starts to come up, I want to kind of deal with it if I can on that level rather than on, you know, running into the jaws of death level. And it's kind of like those little lessons that come up every day. You know, if it starts to come up, if you can just be conscious of it at the time and just, and then kind of confront it right then on a easier level than waiting for, you know, or trying to take on giant things. So it's just, I like that question because sometimes it's, you've got to confront your fears and you got to, you know, make that call. And I'm a little more of a wuss in that department. I'd like to deal with something or recognize, you know, the small fears that come up and during the day and try to confront them on that level rather than on a giant level.
You know, it sounds a lot like horse training. You know, you don't wait till the concerns are overwhelming before you try to fix it. You solve the small things and the big things go away.
Yeah, they can go, well, you still have the big things, but if you can train yourself with the small things to deal with them.
Exactly. Okay, next question. What is the luckiest thing that ever happened to you?
So I like that question because early on, you know, when I was trying to build up my business and it was discouraging because you got to build your business up, bodywork business, one horse at a time, you know. And what we want to do is we want to get that big trainer or that has tons of horses and they hire you and you're going to be set. And, when you go into the business of, you know, equine bodywork or, you know, working on the horses, that it's hard, you know, you got to be willing to do it one horse at a time. And I remember I got really discouraged early on and my wife was really supportive in this. She said, you know, I was ready to quit or do something different. And I thought, you know, I went to shoeing school for 2 weeks to learn how to put on a shoe without laming the horse. Cause I thought, well, maybe I'll shoe horses and do this on the side. And she said, no, if you just love what you do, you have to stick with it. And so that was really, really good advice. And you have to love what you're doing. But I remember I was, you know, I was here in Fairfield and I was going to drive out to Ohio to a show. And, there was a guy here who knew a guy up in Michigan who raised Polish Arabian race horses who might need a few horses worked on, he said. So I drove all the way up there into northern Michigan and I get there and the place is a mess. And the guy has, you know, a few horses that wasn't caring for very well. And he just thought, well, maybe I could work on one. And it was really just depressing situation. And I'm driving back down after that, after maybe working on one of his horses, and that it was never going to it probably wasn't going to help the horse because he wasn't going to follow up with it. But anyways, and I'm driving down through Michigan and I'm looking for a place to stop for the night. And there's a little mom and pa looking hotel. It wasn't one of the big chains. And I thought, well, I'm going to take a chance on this place. It looks nice. And I go in there and there are no nice little mom and pa hotels around anymore. They're all, if they're a little rundown motel, that's what they are. It's a little rundown motel with a guy with a dirty t-shirt. And I get my room and I go in and I don't even take my shoes off because the carpet's so sticky and it's got cigarette burns in the polyester. You were there. And it was really depressing. And I thought I was kind of at the bottom. And so what I did is I sat there in bed and I meditated and it was kind of like when you get at a certain rock, not rock bottom, but low level, that's as far down as you go. And I meditated and I was thinking, how would I really like my business to go? You know, how would I want this to happen? What would I want? And I was thinking, oh, I just would like the phone to start ringing. you know, the phone rings and people calling me to work on their horses. And so I just got real clear on what it would feel like if the phone just started ringing, you know, and I didn't have to drive to Northern Michigan and go through that experience. And then I went to sleep that night, and the next morning I got in the truck and I'm driving down towards Ohio. And about, you know, 3 hours later, my cell phone rings, and it's Val Kanavy. She was she's a 2-time world endurance champion. And I'd worked on her horses in Ocala the previous season, or that winter. I'd worked on her horses in Ocala, a few of them, and I met her for the first time. I didn't know anything about endurance. And she liked, you know, she liked the results. And so she calls and she says, they just made her chef d'équipe of the U.S. team for the World Equestrian Games in Aachen, Germany. And would I like to go? 3 hours later.
You know. Hey, Jim, what I've figured out is all you have to do is ask.
Yeah, and yes, then get out of the way.
Ask and get out of the way. It's that whole...
But you got to be clear on your asking, you know, that's the hard part, because we attach a lot of, well, how could that happen? But I just got clear. What would it feel like to have the phone ring? And then 3 hours later, I get in the truck, phone rings. I go to the World Equestrian Games.
There you go. Yeah, that's the secret right there. I have a friend from Wales, and she says, intention, attention, no tension. So you got to put the intention out there. You got to ask for it. You got to pay attention to the things that come along from it, but you also got to have no tension. You can't be like, well, so when's it going to happen? Look, I asked 3 hours ago and the phone still hasn't, you know, you can't have that negative spin on it. But yeah, that's...
I just let go of it. I just had that feel, you know, but it's hard to get there. It's hard for us to get there, you know, to let go of all that stuff. And so it's still hard. I have to be really, you know, I get caught up, like, we're really busy now, and I get caught up in all these things that I got to do and a whole list, and I feel behind and pressured. And then if I can just take the time to let go of all that and get clear on stuff, it starts to happen. And if you can look for it in smaller ways, it sometimes is easier. I don't know. I don't want to keep going on all day, but, you know, our local McDonald's here is the slowest McDonald's in the country. Like, if there's 3 cars in line, you're going to be there for like 15 minutes. And so I cuss every time I drive by the place. I won't go there anymore and every time I do go there, I'm in line for 15 minutes. And this morning I kind of, you know, I don't meditate every day, but I did sit and I meditate and I listened to some Eckhart Tolle and I only have to listen to him for like 5 minutes and I get clear on stuff. And then I swung by there this morning, got my bacon, egg and cheese biscuit and my large latte in about 2 minutes. And that's a little thing that just happened because I got clear. I let go of all the negativity on something. Everything's not big, you know, but I was chuckling to myself because I can't tell my wife I went through and got the bacon, egg and cheese biscuit because we're on kind of a, you know, diet. So I wanted to call her and say, hey, guess what? I got through the line at McDonald's through the drive-thru in 1 minute today. And it's because I got clear this morning on what I wanted, but I can't brag to her because I can't tell her that I got the bacon.
So what you've got to do really right now is get really clear on not having your wife hear this podcast is what you've got to do.
Yeah. But she's too busy.
She's too busy.
I'll keep steering
her away.
Okay,
so you guys listening,
do not tell her about the podcast. No, she'll probably, she's really been wanting me to do this podcast with you, so she'll probably hear it. So I just have to get clear on not getting in trouble.
She'll be terribly understanding. Okay, last question for you, Jim. One that you picked. What does it mean to you to be a leader and or a follower?
Well, I liked that question because it has to do with horses, you know. I'm not a pushy person, and I'm not bossy. I don't like, you know, lot rules and things. I like to let people, you know, figure things out, and I like people to be happy. So it's hard for me to be, you know, confrontational or strict or tough, which is hard when you're dealing with a lot of people, you know. And now that we're, you know, we have this business teaching people, we have a lot of people. But with horses, you know, sometimes we think we have to show them who's the boss. You know, I don't hear that so much anymore, but I used to hear a lot, you got to show them who's the boss. And you don't have to show them who's the boss. You just have to be the one that's confident, because when they're pushy or when they're bossing you around, it's not because they're being bossy, it's because they're insecure. You know, they want somebody who's the confident one. Yeah, they want, and if you're the leader, you're not showing them who's the boss. You're showing them who's confident, and you're showing them you're the confident one, and you're safe doing this, and you're confident doing this. And you know, I've never been kicked. Well, since I was a kid, I've never been seriously kicked. In all the work I do down underneath the horse with the legs and everything, and it's because I'm confident with the horse, and I'm just confident, and they really respond to that. And so when that's how you should be a leader. And I think it's easier with horses than with people, because people can complicate things. But, you know, it's not about showing somebody who's the boss and being bossy. It's about just being confident. And then people want to follow you, you know. For me, that's what being a leader is about. Now I'm learning some lessons having people work for me on how you have to be clear, not so much be bossy as be clear on what it is that you want to happen. And then they're on board with it when you're clear about it. But it's interesting, because it's harder with people than with horses. We think too much. People think too much. And you asked like, what's a favorite saying or quote, but my favorite thing is thinking's way overrated, you know? You just have to kind of show what the way you want to do it or be a good example, and people will want to follow you then. And horses definitely will want to follow you or go along with what you want if you're not showing them who's the boss. They might do it out of fear of but they won't do it because they're feeling safe following you doing it.
Yeah, there's a couple of ways of going about that, isn't it? And they're different outcomes. They might look somewhat the same on the outside, but the outcome on the inside's a lot different.
Yeah, on the inside.
Very, very cool. So,
well, I told you that when we started talking that we wouldn't have need to worry about anything to talk about, because once I get going, the problem is stopping me. So
yeah, you and me both. Does your wife give you grief about that? Well, mine does.
Nah.
Definitely does. Well, Jim, it's been such a fun conversation with you. If people want to know more about Jim and the Masterson Method, where's the best place to look that up?
Well, on our website, mastersonmethod.com, and we have, I can do the commercial, we have Beyond Horse Massage book and DVD. Light to the Core is a DVD for people that really like the light work. But and we have a lot of YouTube videos on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, that I like to share this. So the way I've always looked at it is, I put stuff out there for people to just learn how to do on YouTube, or show them at demos, you know, at the expos, and they can go try it. And if they like it and it's something they want to learn more, then they can come to the next level. Like, so they can go on, people don't have to buy the book and DVD. They can go on our YouTube video, and on our website, we have free training videos that we have on YouTube, and go how to learn to do some things. And if you get good results and you like it, then you can do the next thing, which might be buy a book or DVD or take a weekend seminar. And then we have advanced courses. But it's always just, you know, to take one step at a time and see, you know, it might resonate with some people, but it might not resonate with other people. But the short answer to that is mastersonmethod.com.
Perfect. Yeah, I would recommend anybody take a look at that and at least try the Blood and Meridian, because you will definitely see not only see amazing results with your horses, but I think you'll find some changes in you too. And I think that's, you know, this whole podcast is about, it's horsey based, but it's really about helping people find some deeper meanings in life.
It was refreshing to have it was fun too to have this conversation, and not just being about horses, because it's really about, you know, the people and their horses, you know, what we do. I mean, it's about the horses, but And this has been a nice interview because you're not just talking about horses. You know, we're able to talk about people and awareness and, you know, things that are probably helpful in life other than making your horse do what you want it to do.
I think there's plenty of places people can find that these days. So. Awesome. Well, Jim, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and a great honor to have you on the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
My honor. Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to when we can, like, get out there and come across the cross paths again.
Yeah, I'm looking
forward
to getting back to some horse expos too. So thanks again, everybody at home. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Journey On podcast, and we will hopefully see you on the next one.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.